Imagine the...
His guest, Paula Harris, the celebrated author, journalist, and international director for the Exopolitics Institute.
Welcome, everyone, to the September 22nd edition of A Global Focus. Trish Sheridan speaking. This evening, it's a privilege to present as guest, Paula Harris. We welcome our listeners on UPRN 105.3 FM New Orleans, an international paranormal radio network, now broadcasting across our beautiful nation to more than 282 cities and worldwide to more than 92 countries for the latest stats. Welcome to our listeners on AussieCast in Australia and in the network Virtual Auditorium on PalTalk, found at www.paltalk.com in the Social Issues and Politics category. Also, now listeners can additionally access the program through UpSnap by calling 704-631-4060 and entering your four-digit station ID code 2899. Also, thank you to Joe Montaldo, founder and director of the Paranormal Radio Network, for making these broadcasts possible. Returning to today's program, it's an honor to welcome Paula for her second book. Paula Harris is truly the celebrated Italo-American author and investigative journalist, the international director for the Exopolitics Institute, and a course instructor for its academic programs. Paula Harris holds a master's degree in education and has instructed at academic institutions in the United States and Italy. On the subject matter of an extraterrestrial presence engaging the planet, Paula has interviewed in person numerous experts and professionals, including scientists, researchers, military, and political personnel of high rank. One can appreciate the vast scope and major importance of Paula's research on these issues from reading her two books. The first book, entitled Connecting the Dots, Making Sense of the UFO Phenomenon, represents a true text in these matters. The new edition of Connecting the Dots contains previously unpublished interviews of Dr. and Colonel Jesse Marcel Jr. and the late Dr. John Mack. Paula's second book is entitled Exopolitics, How Does One Speak to a Ball of Light? Exopolitical Challenges and Protocols for Future Contact. The expression ball of light, referenced in the title, relates to the phenomena of orbs and illuminated spheres, including those spheres seen in film sequences shot during the STS-75 NASA mission. Paula's website can be accessed at www.paulaharris.com. Wonderful updates there. Make sure to check the site frequently. Also, the site is mirroring Italian, French, and German versions. Now back to Paula and her credentials. They're outstanding. Her program this evening is particularly appreciated. Her busy schedule with several conferences, even this summer, in Hawaii, Wales, New Mexico, California, Nevada, and with the very latest this weekend at the 10th Annual Bay Area UFO Expo in Santa Clara, California, the September 27th and 28th, with website www.thebayareaufoexpo.com. Paula will be instructing a new course of this fall semester of the Exopolitics Institute, with the new semester beginning today, the 22nd. Paula's course is entitled Developing the Road to Disclosure, Quantum Cosmology, and the Whistleblowers. For course registration, refer to the website www.exopoliticsinstitute.org. Paula's outstanding credentials, again, are several. Her works have been published globally. Since 1979, Paula Harris has investigated extraterrestrial phenomena. From 1980 to 1986, Paula was the assistant to Dr. J. Allen Hynek in his ufology research. Paula has interviewed several military witnesses of high rank on their knowledge of the truth embargo. In 1997, Paula Harris met and interviewed Colonel Philip Corso in Roswell, New Mexico, and became his consultant. She contributed to the publication of Colonel Corso's book, The Day After Roswell, for which she wrote the preface and translated into Italian. Paula has made several presentations on all aspects of disclosure across Europe, including Ireland, England, Italy, San Marino, Switzerland, Germany, and Belgium. Her new nonprofit organization, Starworks Italia, continues to present American conference speakers in Italy and to promote disclosure and exopolitical dialogue at the global level. Paula Harris is a regular column in the publication Area 51 UFO Magazine. She also has written articles for several newspapers and magazines, including Nexus, Australia, and Explorer. Paula, please pardon that lengthy introduction, but your credentials and research scope require it. And there's so much occurring in the exopolitical field. It's wonderful to have the opportunity to speak with you this evening.
Thanks a lot, Therese. That was really wonderful. I really, you know, have been in the field a long time, and it's part of a passion that I have to get, you know, to get to truth about the probably the most important question we have for humanity.
Indeed, and you are one of the most credentialed reporters, and your interviews have been one-on-one, fully confirming the facts and going into the really multi-aspectual nature of this field. Now, Paula, you've referenced in your work the aspect of synchronicity in the development of your investigative career. Do I assume correctly, Paula, that your work with Dr. J. Allen Hynek and Colonel Philip Corso reflect a providential hand in directing your research in this field?
Yeah, it would have to, because I find myself with all the top players in the field, and I wrote about this in my book, Connecting the Dots, how, you know, I had seen close encounters. I was very emotionally, involved with it, because I saw the part at the end where François Truffaut, the director, you know, welcomes the beings, and there's a predestined landing. Well, when I watched that and I had this emotional reaction to it, at the time, coincidentally, I was teaching science fiction. And I had a list of 10 people I wanted to meet, among them Ray Bradbury, Richard Sigismund, Alan Hynek, several people. And I happened to be in Chicago, where Northwestern University was. And, and I went to see Alan Hynek at the KUFOS, the Center for UFO Studies that he founded, and I never thought that he'd actually be there, but he was not only there, but he asked me to start doing his Italian translations for him. So the fact that I was invited to this wedding, the fact that I went to Chicago, the fact that I, you know, saw Alan Hynek in KUFOS, at KUFOS was already incredible. And then in 1997, the 50th anniversary of Roswell, when my office in Italy, I was living in Italy at the time, asked me to cover the 50th anniversary. They told me to look for Colonel Philip Corso, and I didn't know what he looked like, and I hadn't read the book, and they asked me to interview him. But the whole entire city was filled with, filled up, the rooms were already booked. And so when I got there, I asked them if I could find a room, and they said, look in the phone book. And the first place that I looked was the Sally Port Inn, and the room that I got, and happened to be a room available, which was a miracle in itself, the room that I got was right next to Colonel Philip Corso. And I didn't know it at the time, but the fact that I had the room next to him, that I was able to interview him, that I had access to him, was also a miracle. So, you used the word a providential hand, but something wanted me to start working on this and to be involved with these top level players. And, you know, I find that in my life in general, Therese, that, you know, I meet these wonderful people who give me a hand in the research, although I've got to tell you, I've never seen a UFO and I've never been contacted.
Okay, very well noted. Paula, the synchronicities in your life really have been amazing. And, you know, just briefly, could we touch on the Colonel Philip Corso information? I know I read both your interviews, Philip Corso appearing first in the Connecting the Dots and secondly in the Exopolitics book. Extremely interesting. Now, I find particularly intriguing the concept of electromagnetic pillars, which, if I understand correctly from the description in Connecting the Dots, over the type of gateway affecting the alien craft, and that the day prior to your interviewing Colonel Corso, you had witnessed a violent storm near Roswell, and in fact, during the interview the day after, Colonel Corso mentioned the connection there of the Roswell weather and this electromagnetic aspect with pillars really impacting on that crash, the crash of those vehicles.
Yeah, you know, he told me, you know, actually, all of New Mexico is very weird, Therese. I mean, the whole entire area. Colonel Corso was also the head of a nuclear missile battalion there, and he told me the missiles went up faster there, that that the weather, the whole atmosphere there was a little particular. And then you think that's exactly where they, you know, in White Sands is where they developed the atom bomb. And I'm wondering exactly if New Mexico is filled with anomalies, weather anomalies. But he did mention that to me, and that's the first time I've ever heard of anybody speaking about some kind of portal or Stargate. But because of the electrical weather, the electrical storms that caused these, he said, these magnetic pillars. But he also told me on other occasions that he thought that particular, there were several crashes in New Mexico, not just Roswell. They say there's one in Aztec, there was one on the plains of St. Augustine. There wasn't just one. But what he told me was that at that time the radar was so powerful that our radar system could have also brought them down. So that is another theory.
You know, several aspects there to that account. And you know, Paula, what I found very interesting as well that you note in ExoPolitics when you interviewed Paul Hellyer, the former Canadian Defense Minister and past Deputy Prime Minister of Canada, that Mr. Hellyer was very impressed by Colonel Philip Corso's book, The Day After Roswell, and he actually received confirmation as to the accuracy of the details from such experts as an American general. Boy, that's quite a confirmation there.
Yes, well, you know, I'm a very good friend of the ex-Minister of Defense, Paul Hellyer. He's another one of the people, you know, coincidentally, that I also interviewed. My interview with him went all over the world in 5 different languages. And the thing with Paul Hellyer, though, is that he not only talked to the American general. I've talked to him. He has talked to several military people. And what they've told him was that Colonel Corso's tale of the story of back engineering alien technology is true, and they added, and more. So that means that there's a whole hidden situation here about the back engineering of alien technology. In other words, you need to know that there have been more than those crashes. If you read Ryan Wood's book, Magic Eyes Only, he's got a list of crashes from all over the world. And from what we understand, and this has been told to me by Clifford Stone, whose job it was to clean up ET crashes, Clifford Stone's story is amazing, and he lives in Roswell also, is that these crashes, when they happen, the Americans are the first ones on the scene, and that technology is what's so sacred to keeping the secret in this whole situation. It's not about the aliens. It's not about the UFOs. It's about the technology, because these beings are not flying around using petroleum and gas. So, you know, the fact that Colonel Corso's book was a turning point in ufology, and the fact that Paul Hellyer is talking about it being an exopolitical question, in other words, this deals with policy issues, with possible, you know, electromagnetic technologies, with technologies that might save the planet, with a lot of other things, it makes this whole field, this whole UFO field, something that very, very important, that needs to be studied and looked at.
Absolutely, and very informative comments there. And, you know, even recently, I can recall Mr. Hellyer mentioning the importance of alien technologies as possibly providing some of the resolutions for the energy problems. Also, Victor Vigiani very strongly speaking out about that from his vantage point there at ExoPolitics Toronto. You know, Paul, you were so right about that alien technology aspect. Also, I wish I remembered which interviews. At least 2 or 3 times I read in your books about a particular project called Project Pounce, I believe it is, P-O-U-N-C-E. And I note from your wonderful interview there of Colonel Corso in the ExoPolitics book that there is reference to the alien technology furnishing the possibilities for, at least partially, the possibility for lasers, fiber optics, night vision discoveries. Also, and I thought this was really interesting too, in connecting the dots, Colonel Corso is noted as mentioning the symbiotic or well, that's how I'm interpreting it, like a symbiotic aspect to the alien craft, which was managed by drones especially purposed for space travel. In fact, they had creators more or less keeping tabs on them. Also, if I'm not mistaken, there was a reference to microchips in the Exopolitics book. And finally, I really think very intriguing, Colonel Corso's concept of the importance of looking for intentions.
Yeah, you know, going back to some of the things you said, what was flying the Roswell craft were extraterrestrial biological entities. They were beings that, well, he said, were nourished electromagnetically, that when they put the hands on their panel of the ship, they flew it with their brain. In other words, they were one with the ship. Now, there's been a lot of accounts where they talk about the ship being alive. I think David Adair said he touched a ship when he was very young and it was alive. It's a biological creation, I mean, of some kind. And these beings, they had one job, and that is to fly the craft and to surveil. Because Colonel Corso then added, when I talked to him, that they had found a microchip in the eye of one being and in the forelobe brain. He also said to me several things. He said, if we knew that that were true, that there was this microchip was reporting back to the creators, he said the thing that we were most afraid of were that the creators were like us. In other words, that they were human beings, that they looked like us, and they could be walking in the halls of the Pentagon. So here they are looking at people coming from other planets, but because they couldn't possibly come or they decided not to come, they sent these biological entities to do the job, whatever they were, and then to report back to the people. Which just recently, I've been doing my presentations on human-looking aliens, and that is the thing that scared the military the most, because you can't tell the difference if you see these kinds of people. You certainly can tell the difference when you see a little gray being with big eyes. And, you know, and I didn't even realize that the big black eye was a, a light collector, because Colonel Corso said that they had peeled off that piece, that he had seen that piece. It was part of his, what he called the nut file that he had, the actual artifacts. And he said that they were using that piece, that light collector, he said, to look up and down the hallways near his office, and they could see in the dark. This gets really, really complicated. You know, the biggest argument, and I have to tell you this, Therese, that people use that this isn't necessarily so, says that these technologies, the laser, the microchip, and all of that were started before Corso said that he gave the money to the industries. But there is a reason for that, because the Army Air Force didn't split off until 1948 into the Air Force and the Army, which are two separate branches. And Colonel Corso, when he speaks exclusively for the Army. So he's confessing that the Army had contracts for these things. God knows what the Air Force had, and I'm sure they did it before 1960, which is when Corso got his artifacts. So suppose the Air Force started way sooner. They gave contracts to the big business, because it is big business or corporate, you know, big, and he even names the businesses. I think he said Monsanto was one. He said American, you know, Bell Labs was another. You know, they started way back, probably with another branch of the military, back engineering these things. And the patents were then taken by the engineers, and they got credit for it. And Colonel Corso also adds in his testimony, and he is not lying, that these should have been given to the American people, you know, the night screening devices, some of these things, the laser. After the military use, it was given to the American people.
Very good point there. And, you know, on the aspect of technology also, I very much appreciated your interview in connecting the dots with Ed Fouché. I hope I'm not mispronouncing his name, or is it Ed Fouché?
Ed Fouché, he's French, mm-hmm. Yeah, but he's more than Ed Fouché. He's Ed Fouché Rothschild. He comes from the Rothschild family.
Well, you know, I'll tell you, I found so intriguing his discussion of the TR-3B and TR-3A craft development. And I've got to say, indeed, those American R&D industries are extremely proficient and gifted, and really interesting information there.
Well, you know, Ed Fouché doesn't speak anymore. I got him when his story first came out. He wrote a book with Brad Steiger, who's very, very famous, called Alien Rapture. And all these people, you know, this is the way they do it. They'll write a book of fiction putting real information there. And so Seth Fouché had worked on the Area 51 base, and a lot of the people that had spoken, he said, were murdered. He was scared to death. In fact, he only spoke for 2 years. And when he and Brad Steiger came out with Alien Rapture, and when I interviewed him from Italy, I mean, I was so lucky. I was one of the first people to really talk to him because I heard he had a lot of trouble after he spoke. He talked about these amazing craft that were being developed on the Area 51 base. Now, we know there's a long runway there. There's huge hangars. We know from Bob Lazar, who was one of the first whistleblowers there, that there were craft there, you know, different ships there. And you know, these people have no real reason to lie. They have no real reason to come forth because their lives are miserable after they tell, you know, they tell humanity the truth about what happens in that particular area. And I want to add, Therese, too, since we're talking about the TR-3B, the Aurora, and all these advanced planes, that I just came out of Area 51. I had done a conference at Alamo about 3 weeks ago. Alamo is in Nevada, just close to Area 51. And if people go on my website, Therese, they'll see that I photographed what looks like an anomalous object right up against the mountain when we were going down the Groom Lake Road to the, you know, gate at Area 51.
You know, I noticed those photos at your website, www.paulaharris.com. That does look like some type of a craft, and it's those are very intriguing photos to view. That also sounded like a very interesting conference as well, as it was occurring in close proximity, or in the general area, rather, to Area 51. Also, there were night watches entailed, too, and fine lectures given by yourself, Jim Sparks, Ike Bishop, and others. Sounds like an event that was extremely worthwhile to attend. Now, at this point, lest I forget, I want to welcome all our listeners on UPRN 105.3 FM New Orleans and the Global Paranormal Radio Network. You know, Paula, I just have to rush to this question because when you mention the technology, the information, and even the possible already diplomatic liaison with some of these beings, I'm just going right to your interview in Connecting the Dots with Dr. Michael Wolf-Cravant, a neurologist, flight surgeon, JD, Air Force colonel, pilot, and possible diplomatic liaison between government authorities and certain ETs. Paula, is it true you wrote the preface to his book, Catchers of Heaven? Now, could you give us more details? I guess he also appreciated the physical and spiritual nature of these fields, as did Dr. J. Allen Hynek.
Well, I didn't write the preface to his book in America. You know, Michael Wolf is a real enigma. In the field, you know, there are people that actually, you know, it's like they love him or hate him. They don't know that much about him. And I honestly have to tell people that the reason why I can do so much work on Dr. Wolf is because I went to see him 3 times. All my interviews are in person. And after I went to see him the first time, he said to me, I want you to write about me, he said, but I will talk to you once a week, and he did for almost a year. He called me in Rome for almost once a week, and he had me audio tape everything he said to me. And his story is like a lot of the other contactees. The book, Catchers of Heaven, is really difficult to read, and you can't get it anymore because it is out of print, and if you get a copy, it's about $300, so it's really, really difficult to get it. But his story is like Clifford Stone's and so many other. They are, as children, they are contacted, or in Michael's case, he was abducted at the age of 3. He and his brother saw the UFO. They found Michael wandering around in a daze. After a while, Michael showed a very high increase in his intelligence quotient. He became very, very intelligent. I mean, his intelligence quotient was so high that it was his science teacher who recommended him to the military, because his father was already in the military. Michael tells me that he was brought to Princeton University, where his IQ was measured, that he met Einstein, that right away he started working for the intelligence community. He worked in the CIA, he worked for the Department also for the DIA. He worked in the Secret Service for a long time. Because he had the ability that Clifford Stone has, because Clifford Stone also, who cleaned up crashes, developed ESP. And Michael, because of his extrasensory perception, he started remote viewing, and he worked in highly classified programs. He went to get these degrees in black projects, which Michael explained to me, like he would go to McGill University, he would work on a doctorate, and the intelligence community would give huge amounts of money to the university. Michael would, all of his records would be, completely erased. So he's very controversial because it's difficult to find a lot of records on Michael. However, when I visited Michael, he had from the New York Academy of Sciences these 6 PhDs, including neurology, genetics, electromagnetics, all of them. And so here's from the New York Academy of Sciences. This was given to him. They should look at this, you know. This is an example of the secret government or the black projects. So Michael was an amazing and very spiritual person. I know you were fascinated by him because so many people were. And I had told you before, you know, Therese, that the only time I've ever encountered really strange situations is interviewing Michael Wolff. In other words, paranormal situations.
That intriguing information that he also provides is something that I like to actually mention to my fellow ICAR members. We do have members in ICAR who consider the Greys to be a group of beings whom... Well, they don't find negative acting. And I found this kind of an interesting viewpoint on their part, but I've got to admit that Dr. Michael Wolff Cravant considered them to be really good beings, and that his lifelong relationship with them and the relationship of his father and I believe a past generation with them had positive effects on their lives. That's kind of an interesting mix in the information.
Well, you know, I don't know how to tell this to people, but there are several types of gray beings. The one that Michael was involved with was, you know, his name was Colta, and he was what you call a baby gray. He did not have the big eyes. He had very small eyes, and on the cover of Catchers of Heaven is a photograph of Colta. That is not a drawing of Colta. That's a photograph. And I've heard other people talk about what you call these baby grays. They're not like the Zeta Reticulans. They're different. And Colta belongs to a different group, group of grays. And Colta's job was basically to look at Michael as a specimen. In fact, Michael talks about it in his book that Colta used to take Michael's stethoscope to hear Michael's heart, would communicate with him telepathically. And I have to honestly tell you that when Adriano Forgione and I left Michael Wolff's apartment at 10:30 at night, we were followed out of his apartment by strange-sounding sounds. And they sounded like dolphin sounds, squeaky dolphin sounds. And we didn't know what it was. We thought it was the elevator. And so when we called Michael the next morning and said, Michael, this noise as we're coming out of here, he said, didn't you see them? They followed you out. And I said, what? He said, there were two of them here. Two like Colta, and they were very curious about human love, and they were watching us here, and they followed you out the door. Well, we certainly didn't see them, but we certainly heard them, and because we never heard noise, you know, high-pitched sounds like that ever. And that and the fact that in the middle of the night, I thought I saw it from the window, this very strange blue porthole open up. I turned on all the lights and stopped the phenomenon, but I really thought that Michael had the actual ability to send his visitors to visit. And then I'll tell you another story, Therese. You don't know this. It's not in any book yet. But I got a call from a Colonel Philippe Messier from Montreal, Canada, who sent me a photograph of him and Michael actually taken by Colta or one of these grays, because he said he walked out of Michael's bedroom. And there's a picture of this gentleman, who's a count, a French count, with Michael. And you can see he's not looking at the camera because he's freaked out totally. And Michael's smiling at the camera, and in a reflection in the glass behind him of this baby gray. I was just shocked because I had been to Michael's apartment 3 times and I had never seen anything. And this man actually said, when I went there, I saw this. The gray walked out of Michael's bedroom. Now, of course, he walked out of a dimensional portal because there's no way of traveling. So he'd have to open up a portal in Michael's bedroom to walk out of there. But this, the Michael Wolff story, and I will write a book about this, is the most fascinating contact story I've ever heard. And I have to say one more thing, Therese, because for all the people that didn't believe Michael Wolff, when we were doing his translation in Italy, we did have a visit from the intelligence community to our offices who verified that Michael Wolff was real and was an undercover agent.
Boy, that information is so intriguing. Now, right off the bat, I can say very factually, last night in the ICAR UFO Alien Phenomena Room, there was a reference by Joe as to several reports of people hearing dolphin-like noises. Now, this was just off the out of the blue. I had not referenced your excellent book on this. Dolphin-like noises. I, too, have heard kind of odd chirps at night. Don't know quite why. And the blue portal, I have heard of that from a dear ICAR friend. So lots of interesting information there. And, you know, I just have to get that Catchers of Heaven book. It sounds like a very valuable reading. Now, I note a question coming in, Paula, from David Andrew. He's a key ICAR researcher. And David wants to know, Paula, if by chance you have any possible timetable or just thoughts on a possible disclosure in the future.
Well, first of all, tell David that I don't ever think it's going to come from the government. They can't do that. I mean, it wouldn't even be worth their while because there's so much there that they lied about. I mean, they couldn't ever admit it. But, you know, Stephen Greer, who did speak to government people and people who really want this out, said it has to come from grassroots. In other words, it has to be the people that want to find out and the people that do all the work. So I think that the disclosure will never be governmental. What a little it might be, and it might look like this. It might look like that we have like 2 or 3 mass sightings over major airports, and then we have to talk about what they are. Or that's about how it'll be. It'll be the ETs that'll show themselves, and then we don't know what brand or what kind or what types or where who's inside the craft. Because I really want to take the focus away from the grays. Okay, because there are human-type ETs that are riding around in those craft, not only the Pleiadians, but a whole other group. Because I did the story on the Clarions, and there's all kinds of other beings from other planets that have had contact, especially in South America, that are not of the gray race.
Boy, that's interesting. You know, I do remember your presentations referencing the Clarions, the wonderful work of your interviews with Maurizio Cavallo, also the interface of human-type aliens with individuals in Italy. I think it was back probably mid-20th century. Very interesting work there.
Well, you know, I just finished the book, Alien Bases. You can tell all your people that are listening by Timothy Good. Tell them to read that book. Alien Bases talks about all the contacts in South America, in Brazil, in Argentina, in Venezuela. People, you know, that are like farmers and regular people where they have aliens come up to them who look like us, women and men, with one-piece suits. Adamski, who meets these Venusians, you know, in California near Mount Palomar. We had our own Adamski was Eugenio Siracusa at the foot of Mount Etna on the island of Sicily. He met with these tall, blonde beings. They were not Pleiadians. They were from other planets, and people have seen these beings. The town saw them walking around. So, you know, there are very many visitations from very many different beings who have very many different agendas. So I would like to take the focus off the gray, who is one type of being, and there are different types of grays also. But Michael Wolff interfaced with someone from Altair 4. The photograph of this someone, this blonde-haired being, is on his book, Catchers of Heaven. And Michael said that this being was a guest of the government, and the government was talking to this being, and Michael telepathically could communicate with this being.
Boy, that's intriguing. And even to just Google on the net the name Catchers of Heaven, the image of that particular gray is really a fascinating one to look at.
Yeah, he doesn't look like your regular gray. I call him a baby gray because he has the small eyes, you know. So, I mean, I'm thinking to myself that, you know, in my book, Exopolitics, you probably read the Dan Burrish story. Well, the J-Rod is a gray, too, you know. Mm-hmm. I mean, he was also gray, and he happened to say that he's a mutated a form of us from the future. Well, if he's a mutated form of us from the future, he told Dan Burrish that he had a wife and child, and he told him where he came from, you know. So the thing is that, you know, it's very interesting. It's very complex, this field, Therese. It's very complex.
You know, indeed, excellent points. That is the case. You know, too, and I hope my memory serves me correctly here. It's my understanding that Sergeant Major Robert Dean, who one of his service locations was at the Supreme Headquarters, Allied Powers, European facility, SHAPE facilities in Paris, was mentioning the importance of these subject matters to the various authorities. If I remember correctly, Sergeant Major Dean was mentioning that there are very human-looking ETs right now that could possibly be interacting with the population or just visiting. I hope I remember correctly. I do know he worked at SHAPE, and he's a wonderful speaker.
Yeah, he did, and I've been told that they are around also. I was told that there was one when I was doing a conference in Marseille in France. I have a very close friend of mine who's Belgium's most important psychic. He's a young man. He's 30 years old. And he told me that there would be one sitting in the audience. I never saw who it was because they all looked the same to me. People looked the same. But, you know, he said to me, Paula, there is someone that does not live on this planet. And I'm convinced anymore that, you know, they're especially in Norway and Sweden and in Scandinavia, you're going to find a few of those people. The Charles Hall story in his book, Millennium Hospitality, said that his dentist met someone that was very unusual, that had different set of teeth than we did. And there are people that have, like, webbed feet and webbed hands that they have seen. So, and he said of the Scandinavian, in Scandinavia. So, you know, even though we look at our everyday American life, you know, the whole planet is not America. There are people that are having contact in Argentina, in Australia, in Norway, all over the world. And they may be meeting some of these individuals.
Boy, that's intriguing. And you know, with Charles Hall, yes, he mentions in Millennial Hospitality, the four books, not only very fascinating encounters with the tall white race, but also that second race, the Norwegians. And, you know, to me, his testimony is extensive, it's credible, and does provide some really intriguing details of possibly two neutral races. And it adds more information to the discussion for certain.
Yeah, but it also says that there have been, that these people had kids with them, children. That blew me away when I read those
yes.
books. Because, first of all, Charles is a military man. He's still working in military base. I mean, he is telling the truth. He was not prepared for his contact in 1965. He was nowhere prepared for it. But can you imagine meeting them with their children? What does that mean? These people have families? And then I'm looking at, you know, the idea. If they have families, and also if you read the book, it says that the teacher, the mother, wanted her children to play with human children. That's an exopolitical situation. It's how do you meet somebody that has children, and how do you have them play with human children, and how do we deal with it? Sounds like Star Trek, doesn't it?
And, you know, it confirms, too, the point you make that we really need to begin establishing protocols. You mentioned several very good suggestions in your book, Exopolitics. You're right. This matter is extremely diversified and with really important areas to it.
Well, yeah, one of the protocols, though, is if you see somebody that you think might not be from here, I mean, what do? Go up and touch them, or do you shake hands, or do you communicate, or what do you do? I mean, Charles said that he would stand very still so that he wouldn't threaten these people, and he said also that, you know, he wouldn't just touch them. He said, if you read my Exopolitics book, I talk about the Virginia case, where the military policeman, Marco Sharif, 24-year-old military policeman, took one of the aliens, put him on his lap, took him to the hospital, and this alien was a little being, but he had reddish skin. Well, you know, Marco Schriess did his job as a military policeman, but he died 2 weeks later because he was exposed to a virus. He had tumors under his arm, and Roger Lear did that case. He went down and spoke to the doctors, wrote a book, I think it was called The Doctor and the Scalpel, about the Virginia case, and you can't touch necessarily people that come from somewhere else, or they shouldn't be touching you, because you could hurt each other with viruses or, you know, any kind of germs that you have. Also, since they may not be speaking the way you speak, that's the reason I have that title, How Do You Speak to a Ball of Light, on my exopolitics book, because some of them appear in light energy, and they're not speaking a language. They are talking, or they are communicating telepathically. Well, logically, if you're going to be using contactees to communicate, that's because the contactee usually has a high level of telepathy. And that's why Michael Wolff was used and Clifford Stone was used. The contact was telepathic. So should we be giving telepathy lessons to our children? Should somebody be learning telepathy to communicate with these beings?
Boy, those are very appropriate comments, very interesting. You know, Paula, one thing that ICAR has found in its research is a heightened degree of telepathy among many of the experiencers, and actually an enhanced common trait for empathy. Also, when you mention the telepathy, I'm thinking of the case of Dan Sherman, and I also had, in the interim, just quickly checked Dr. Richard Boylan's piece on Dr. Michael Wolff Cravant, and he was mentioning the authenticity of the Dan Sherman case, and if I remember correctly, from the interview, Dan Sherman, on Project Camelot, rather, was mentioning how he was recruited because of his great telepathic ability. Boy, good points there. And
well, Dan Sherman did he do above top secret?
I think so, or one of those books. I apologize. I don't remember the correct title.
It was where he was learning everything from a gray that was on the other side of the. He was on a console, and they were communicating telepathic. He was communicating telepathically with a gray. Well, you know something. You know, there's a lot of cases like that, Therese. But it's sad because Dan Sherman, I think, was in the military. I mean, why is it just the military that gets to do that? It's like, you train people in the military to be remote viewers. Well, you know, if people had telepathy and they could remote view, their life would be easier. They would find their car keys. They would be able to find a parking spot. They would be able to do all kinds of things because they already would have an intuition that worked. And I not only think it's good for communicating with ETs, but it's good for your everyday life. We should be having some classes in that.
As enhancement of personal abilities. Well, you know, too, I remember Joe Montaldo did a great interview with Dan Sherman a couple of months back where people are checking the archives. And, you know, back to that Brazilian case, boy, that was an interesting account. You have an exopolitics, Paula. Also, it included the translation from the Portuguese by Gilles Bourdet of one of the doctor's transcripts, or interviews, rather. And the doctor was saying that... It was very interesting.
It's A.J. Gebhard, because Gilles de Bourdet... A.J. Gebhard is the Brazilian researcher.
That's
French, yeah. And A.J. Gebhard is one of our people on the board of Laughlin, on the board of directors of the Laughlin Conference. He will be in Laughlin this year. The thing about A.J., and I don't know if you've ever met him, is that A.J. In Brazil does a lot of good work, and he gets his files from the military. Now, you know, if we could only do this. I mean, the military just, the Army just goes and gives A.J., as a regular researcher, all the files, and he's able to get all this information, and he puts out a book in Portuguese, and, I mean, a magazine in Portuguese, a magazine that people buy. It's treated very normally in Brazil. I mean, this is treated like it's no big deal in Brazil. What we are going for in the United States is that it gets treated like no big deal here, and that maybe the military give a few files for researchers to study.
Wow, because, you know, I know from the intro, I might be misconstruing here, but I thought one of the doctor's transcripts was translated by Gilles as well. But what I do remember, well, I thought I had to remember that, But I do note here that the policeman's death was attributed by the doctor to being one without rational explanation. Boy, that sounds very important for a need for protocol, because it actually sounds quite important to the public welfare. People dying without rational...
Yeah, this 24-year-old boy, and I think maybe you're right about that he helped AJ with the translation, because they were very, very good friends. The thing is, this Marco Charisse, the 24-year-old military policeman, had a family. He had a wife and kids. And so what do you tell them? I mean,
exactly.
Your father dies, I mean, your husband dies after he's had this incident, you know, where he's taken the being and put him on his lap. I mean, there's no protection, there's no plastic, there's no anything. The little being, of course, he was alive. He didn't offer any resistance. He sat there nicely. He was taken to the hospital, but, I mean, Roger Lear's book is fascinating because... he did have an injury on his leg. I guess there was surgery done on him, and Roger Lear spoke to the doctor. So, I mean, these things are really happening. They're real cases, and there's no protocol. And you don't know whether to shake hands, take them to the hospital. You don't know what to do. Nobody knows what to do here. And so the protocols that I listed are several. One of them is to, first of all, distinguish if what's up in the sky is our stuff or their stuff. Because several of the sightings that we've had, especially the one I show in my presentation over the Aviano base in Italy, that UFO coming out of the forest, is not alien. It's our stuff that we've developed. So one of the protocols should be to look at what we're shooting at, look at what we're photographing, to see whose stuff is.
Boy, that's a good point, Paula. You know, I remember your startling footage at the April 2005 X conference of a craft videotaped, I think it's the one you referenced, at Ponte di Giulio, Italy.
Right, Ponte di Giulio, right.
Boy, that was quite the videotape. It has all transfixed. I know I'd never seen it. Well, let's put it this way. It's a very unusual craft, unusual movements. I have seen that, but this was really a startling videotape, and one would think it was a UFO at first looking at it, no question.
Yeah, but the photographer was given an appointment to photograph it. It was on a tripod. It was
mm-hmm.
He was sitting in a sand bed where they do military maneuvers. It was on a military base, and I don't think the aliens made an appointment with him. So what that was it was a debut of a modern craft. I can imagine what we have. I mean, you mentioned Ed Fouché and the Aurora, the pictures of the Aurora, and the TR-3B, I'm sorry. And the Aurora, they're incredible craft. I mean, they're anti-gravity craft. And one of the things is that if we start using these anti-gravity machines, then someone will get the idea we don't need petroleum and oil anymore. And that would be terrible. I mean, it's like if we don't need petroleum and oil anymore, the whole economy goes down the tubes. I really think that there are these incredible technologies, Therese, but they're waiting. There's a timeline. They're waiting for them to come out of the back room with them.
You know, you make some very good points there. Very, very plausible. You know, Paula, before our 8-minute break at the top of the hour, which for you would be 7 p.m. Mountain, I'd like to just mention here this course that you're giving. The semester begins today. It's my strong guess that your class is going to include some really vital information from your interviews with such key people as Paul Davids, executive producer of the film Roswell, and also with other key whistleblowers in the industry and from scientific and military fields. Could you give us more details on your new class at the Exopolitics Institute starting today?
Okay. I have three courses, actually.
Oh. Uh-huh.
One course, the quantum cosmology, is given in the springtime. And the whistleblower course is going to be given in the summer. My brand new course is called Disclosure, Hollywood and Disclosure. And it's a fun course. And I have 5 students so far, one from South Africa, one from China, one from Boulder, Colorado, one from Canada, and one from California. These 5 students are going to be learning how the government used Hollywood films for disclosure. And including the Disney productions. Walt Disney was contracted way back when. A man named Ward Kimball, who created Jiminy Cricket, believe it or not. To help in an easy, soft way to tell humanity how they can handle the idea the contact is real. So I have everything from the Disney productions to Star Trek to Philip Dick, who worked for the intelligence community. Philip Dick wrote Blade Runner, Minority Report, and Paycheck. And there's so much information about time travel and so forth in Philip Dick's movies, in The Matrix, and The Day the Earth Stood Still. That came about after the famous Holloman landing, where these beings talked to President Eisenhower about getting rid of our nuclear. And there, and I'm giving, as part of the class, film clips that people have to analyze, and also philosophies that are in these films, like when Yoda speaks in Star Wars, he's bringing in an Eastern philosophy, and so is Obi-Wan Kenobi and so forth. These courses are fantastic because I give you the film, I give you the questions, and all the people have to do is just write essays around them, and it stimulates critical thinking skills, Therese. And this new course, Hollywood in the Media, in Disclosure, would be an excellent course for young people in a university.
Yes, indeed it would. It sounds as though those courses would be very much a growing experience and would really expose them to this new multi-aspectual discipline of exopolitics and the questions of the ET presence. Good for you. It sounds very, very intriguing. You know, now when we return, I am dying to speak about your interviews with Clark McLellan and also your interview with Dr. Edgar Mitchell. You know, in the interim, I'd like to let me see, we've got 3 minutes. I just would like to note your presenting the aspect of a new paradigm that's necessary for this field. You state that Colonel Corso emphasized a new world concept, Dr. Mack proposes a new world view, and Colonel Jesse Marcel seems to espouse the view that humans are citizens of the universe.
It is a new world view, and it's the only way we can get out of this box, because we're all in a box right now, and unless we look at the cosmos and ourselves as citizens of the cosmos, and look at getting out of this rut, we're in danger. The planet is in danger. Our philosophy is in danger.
You know, that's very true, and it really is time for, you know, the new paradigms, and just to research and just discover new ways of thinking. It makes a great deal of sense to me. Now, let me see. Oh, I noticed, well, that I'm dying to speak about Clifford Stone, too, after the break. Quick question. I remember your interview with Dr. Leo Sprinkle, that he had received reports from clients of a type of galactic confederation. Have you heard that as well from some of the other experiencers?
Well, those photographs that you saw in my presentation, the human faces of,
yes.
You know, Marie de Carvalho, they were all on the same ship. Every time he would have his contacts there near Genoa, near the Ligurian coast there, near the mountains, he would see different kinds of people on the ship. He calls them people because the faces are of people. And they're strange looking, but, you know, almond-shaped eyes with the blue liquid irises and so forth. But he said there is a federation. There are federations of groups of people. Even Billy Meyer, who had his contact with the Pleiadians, they talked about other visitors. They're not the only ones that visited him here. There are different groups of people. So, you know, the idea that, and I'll talk about Gene Roddenberry is part of my class. If people are interested in this class, they can go to the Exopolitics Institute website. Gene Roddenberry was working with Phyllis Schlemmer and got the idea of Deep Space Nine and Star Trek and a lot of that from Challenger material.
Wow, from the Nine. Now, Paula, can we continue with that thought immediately after an 8-minute break? I'm really looking forward to resuming the discussion. Everyone will be back in 8 minutes' time, and thank you for joining us this evening, and we'll be right back after 8 minutes.
Welcome to A Global Focus, with today's guest, Paula Harris, the celebrated author.
Welcome back, everyone, to our discussion with Paula Harris, whom I forgot to mention is also an educator. Paula, I really would like to get some more information on Gene Roddenberry, his connection with the book The Only Planet of Choice by Phyllis Schlemmer, who has contacted the entities called the Nine. Could you give us some more information on that?
Well, you know, there's another book people could read. It's called The Stargate Conspiracy, which talks about the 70s. The 70s are the most important years of all of this, because it's when they started the remote viewing programs and when the CIA got interested with the money that Edgar Mitchell, the astronaut, gave them to do this kind of thing. And there was a gentleman, you know, Croatian, his name was Andrea Poharic. She's the one that pulled out Uri Geller from Israel. Now, Uri Geller, for me, is half alien. But anyway, Poharic had a group of psychics he was working with that would channel, and Phyllis Schlemmer was one of the best. And she channeled a group of disembodied aliens, they didn't have bodies, called the Nine. And all of the channelings of that time, and remember, Andrea Poharic was involved with Uri Geller, who was involved with a Stanford Research Institute, where they were testing him for his powers. So Poharic and Phyllis Schlemmer together were working together with Sir John Whitmore, these three people, in the 70s, in the late 70s, doing these channelings, getting information about the origin of Earth, the origin of the cosmos, who these beings were, the fact that we had to change the way that we thought, that we all had to become more spiritual in order to evolve, that our technology wasn't, that we needed to evolve with our technology. And so Phyllis Schlemmer wrote a book called The Only Planet of Choice, and you can get it from her website. And Gene Roddenberry, who was a policeman, I don't know if people know he was a policeman at the time, had an incredible imagination. He was creating something called Star Trek, but he went to visit Phyllis Schlemmer at her house. He was a guest there for, like she said, a month and a half. And during that period of time, he asked questions of the Nine and was very, very impressed with their answers. So that's why you have one of the series of Roddenberry called Deep Space Nine. Wherever you see Nine, it's a council of Nine, and you can't really put faces on them. They're disembodied entities. And so it's very, very interesting, the whole story.
Indeed. Now, wait one second. I think, you know, the network is expanding so exponentially that sometimes we get another interview feed on, but no, it's stopped now. Thanks. Well, you know, with the network growing as quickly as Paranormal Radio Network is and UPRN. Now, you know, getting back to the Nine, you know what I thought was interesting, too, from your interview in connecting the dots with Phyllis Schlemmer and Sir John Whittemore? They placed, even at that time, an extremely great importance on Israel. And I noticed also your interview with Zachariah Sitkin, that he puts a tremendous importance on Jerusalem. It seems as though these people really had a connection or an interesting analysis or portent of these really current, very important developments occurring in the Middle East.
Well, you're incredible, Therese, because you're putting together the dots. You link the dots just from reading the book, which you're incredible. Yeah, Zechariah Sitchin talked about the Anunnaki, and the Jerusalem happens to be the most powerful spot in the world. It is the birthplace of three major religions. Jerusalem itself, and in the Anunnaki work of Zechariah Sitchin, he said that was mission control for the Anunnaki. Somehow it's placed in a pivotal geographical part of the Middle East. I mean, I don't know what's all there, but, you know, it's a pivotal, important part. And Israel and the whole Israel, you know, the whole Israel-Palestinian thing is a part of the key of the conflict of the world. And the Nine said in their channeling, in the back of my book, it says that, unless that's solved, we're always going to have problems. I mean, it may reflect itself in Iran, Iraq, or wherever, Korea, but the Israeli-Palestinian connection is so very powerful on this planet. It's almost like that's the test. If we can solve that, we can solve all our problems. And I talk about at the end of the book, I talk about all the synchronicities, all the things around Uri Geller, around the 70s, around Phyllis Schlemmer, Andrea Polharich. The fact that these three psychics, Andrea Polharich, with Phyllis Schlemmer and Sir John Whitmore in the Middle East during the time that Kissinger was trying to make peace in the Middle East, use the power of prayer and meditation to have peace come about. Because any time we use our you know, power of good intentions, prayer, meditation, the power of thought, which is so powerful, we have good things happening. I mean, we can actually create good things. When Edgar Mitchell was on the moon, he talked to me about his experiments. You know, they were 95%. They were 95% correct. He was doing ESP experiments from the moon to his group in Florida. And can you imagine if thought is traveling to the moon from the moon to Florida? So, you know, this ESP, or the positive energy around intention, and that book that I mentioned at the back of my book is called The Future Landing on Planet Earth by Stuart Holroyd. I mean, my book has a list of these books, and this was an experiment done by three psychics. And I'm going to bring it back to another thing that is not in my book. Philip Dick knew this, because if you saw the movie Minority Report, there was one man and two women psychics in the water that would see future crimes, and Tom Cruise knew that the most powerful of the three psychics that were in the tank was the woman psychic. And that goes directly to the idea with Phyllis Schlemmer and her energy, or her female energy, that was used during the experiments that they did with psychics in the 70s.
Well, that's intriguing information. And I noticed earlier a comment in the room, and from our key researcher, one of our key researchers, Dave Andrew, as to the importance of activity in the 70s and various reports from experiencers. Now, lest I forget, I wanted to question you a little bit more on the Maurizio Cavallo case. Again, it's true that he had encountered beings mentioning a type of Federation group, also more than just the Clarions.
Yes, there were other people on the ships. In fact, he said they were all different kinds of people. In the photographs, the Polaroids, they're all different looking people. Their head shapes are different. Their eyes are different, and they were part of a Federation that is, you know, kind of visiting the Earth. And their thoughts were this. They said, look, some of us that look just like the humans need to walk among the humans because we raise the vibration just by being among them. In other words, it's like putting a drop of oil in water. You change the water by being among them. And some of them that look very strange cannot walk among us naturally. They're the ones that contact people and raise their you know, their frequency by contacting them. And by the way, contacts are all over the world. They're not just in America. I've talked to contactees almost in every country, and they all have a similar type story. There are different groups of people that travel in a federation that have agreements among them. But since we have federations here on Earth, and we have the United Nations, and we have federations, it's only normal that groups of aliens would also have alliances. And I'm not saying they're all good alliances, but they're alliances for whatever agenda they have.
Very interesting comments. You know, too, during the break you were mentioning, Paula, I thought this was intriguing, too. The concept that there is an alien group called the Omais. I know there's one French professor, Denocla, D-E-N-O-C-L-A, who's done a great deal of work to try to decipher their language. You have heard reference then to this Omite group, or group from Omo.
Yeah, the Omo group. I, you know, there's a lot of European books written about this group, because they're the ones that look like us, too.
Oh.
And there's a lot of sightings of these people in Spain. Michael Wolff, actually, in one of his transmissions when he was talking to me on the phone, said they're in Spain. And I flew to the island of Ibiza in Spain and to talk to a group of French contactees called Le Voyageur Interdimensionnel. And they told me that on that island they had met several really evolved people. And so I'm convinced that there are groups that live together in different places in the world, you know, with their own cultures, whatever they are. And it was very interesting for me to meet these French contactees because they were doing their prayers and their meditations on the water. They all lived in catamarans and yachts on the water. You know, they weren't on the land because they said, and I don't know if this is true, they said that whatever they did was magnified by the water. So if they lived on a boat on the water and did their prayer meditations, whatever they did, it was magnified, and that the world needed this, that they were praying for the world.
Well, prayer is always helpful, and if so, that would be a very positive development. You know, Paula, too, your site has wonderful updates, but also this relates to interviews both in Connecting the Dots and Exopolitics. Recently, there have been very courageous statements of Dr. Edgar Mitchell on the Kerrang radio interview, just continuing his wonderful work. Also, we had that really brave announcement of NASA spacecraft operator and space program pioneer Clark McClelland as to his viewing during his service an extraterrestrial craft and an extraterrestrial in the process of assisting two of the Earth astronauts. And Mr. McClelland said he saw this from his video monitors at the Launch Control Center at Kennedy Space Center. Paula, too, you have excellent interviews, as I mentioned, of Clark McClelland at your website and also in your books. Any further information on that or just comment?
Well, you know, it's a really hard situation with Clark McClelland. First of all, let me tell your listeners that in Nexus Magazine, the October-November issue, Clark has more information on what he saw on the being that he saw. He basically was looking at the monitors and saw a 10-foot-tall alien being dressed in a helmet and a white suit, just like the astronauts. I mean, but he was 10-foot-tall, and he also saw the craft next to the shuttle. In other words, he was floating over the, you know, in the payload of the shuttle, but not attached to anything, speaking to the two astronauts or communicating or whatever he was doing. There is actual an image that Clark McClelland gave me on my website, gave me permission. I waited. He told me to wait until after he had given it to Jeff Rentz. He came out in support of Edgar Mitchell. Now, Edgar Mitchell says he never had any kind of experience except his spiritual epiphany going to the moon. But Edgar Mitchell has been briefed about the Roswell case from top-level people. He has spoken to fellow astronauts who have seen UFOs. Edgar Mitchell knows this is real. And it's really sad that a man of Edgar Mitchell's stature, his credibility, he's an engineer. He's science background. He is not taken seriously enough to be part of that ABC special we all just saw the other day. I mean, you can dismiss this whole entire phenomenon with all these excuses of what it could be, but you don't speak to an astronaut like Edgar Mitchell, who has been not only been briefed that Roswell is real because the ABC special had it still that it's some kind of myth. And, you know, ask the people involved, ask the military people, ask the people, the Disclosure Project witnesses, all those military guys that Stephen Greer accumulated at the Washington Press Club who were involved in landings, like the Rendlesham Forest case in England, you know, Larry Warren that saw the beings come out of the ship. You know, these are people that are credible, that don't want to have this contact experience, that are in the military, that are brave enough to come forth, a lot of them, like Clark McClelland, that have been harassed. So, you know, I don't understand why we're at a point where we're talking about all this as a myth, if it's not real, and so forth, when we have all this evidence. And yes, Clark is, for me, credible because I flew to Florida. You read my book. I when I interviewed him, I had to fly there. I had to look him in the face. I had to sit with him. I had to talk with him. And then we both went to Kennedy Space Center. And that's why the only way I could do that story, because it's so unbelievable that I don't exactly do everybody's story unless I personally meet them.
Very informative comments. And you know, Paula, from your Exopolitics book, and I don't want to be tiresome here, taking too long reading his titles, but just some of them: Structural Designer, Aerospace Engineer Mission Planner, Aerospace Engineer Launch Operations, Technical Assistant to the Apollo Program Manager, Missions Operation Monitor in the Launch Operations Center. Those are really impressive job assignments of Mr. McClelland.
Yeah, but he consequently he lost his job with NASA. Look what he saw. Mm-hmm. Look what he was involved in. If you go to StargateChronicles.org.
Or www.StargateChronicles.com, right.
.com, okay. Then you can see all of his credentials, because then there's, like, you know, signed photographs of, you know, Wernher von Braun, of presidents, and so forth, that knew McClellan. And McClellan is very, very brave, but he's very nervous because he's saying things that are absolutely unbelievable, which he says, basically, bottom line, the same thing Richard Hoagland says: NASA knows a lot, it just can't talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
It knows a lot. It just isn't willing to go there right now. It's hard to explain to people. It's hard to backtrack and say, like, we knew a lot time ago. If you go on my website, too, I think I have some videotape of a UFO going across the moon. I mean, there's videotape of a lot of launches where they've seen UFOs. So if we know this is all true, I guess, you know, we can bury it, or we can say, well, you know, this is true. Now, let's try to find out what this is in a very orderly, scientific, intelligent, academic way. Let's try to find out what this is, because this is a learning curve for humanity. This is where the new world is. Humanity needs to learn. We need to know what's going on, and we need to know what our part in the universe is. These people or these visitations are not people that are on vacation, that they decided to come here because it's a vacation. Whatever is going on, you know, we might want to find out about. And I really believe that you know, there are groups, secret groups, in the military and NASA and so forth, like Richard Hoagland believes, that really are studying this, but they aren't sharing their information.
Very powerful points there. And, you know, Paula, I just received a wonderful question from Dee Andrew, who is the National Director for ICAR and also the host of the very popular Eye to the Sky, the UFO Synopsis on Saturday evenings. Now, this is Dee Andrew's question. She wants to know, Paula, if you know anything about that recent Romanian jet that collided with a UFO. This Romanian case is about a year old, but there are very few details in English, and it was on a Romanian TV news broadcast. And if you could just ask your contacts, maybe they have heard of this Romanian crash.
Absolutely, I will ask. Oh, it's very important. Yeah, no, I absolutely. And this was an actual collision.
Yes.
Okay, well, see, there's exopolitics for you. If people don't think this is a matter of national security, I don't know what is. I mean, there's a collision, or you look at the Maelstrom Air Force shutdown of the 10 missiles. My goodness, that's
yes.
National security.
And, you know, pardon me, no, I misspoke there. Goss said, no, there wasn't. The jet landed safely. The Romanian jet landed safely, but it was badly damaged. But, boy, we'd love information, if you have any information, because your network is so extensive. You've interviewed so many whistleblowers, so many experts and researchers.
Well, tell Dee, can I have the dates and can I have the place? Cause I need
absolutely.
The date, and she could email me the dates and the places, because I can't just say 1 year ago. I have to get, like, details as to where this was.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, this kind of, I promise I only have two more questions on Clark McClellan's comments. But first of all, before I do that, I just wanted to note again your great interview with Dr. Edgar Mitchell in the Exopolitics book. You emphasized his great appreciation for science, noetics, and ethics. It was a really good interview. And also, on Clark McClellan, I was thrilled to hear him mention his reference to meeting Senator Barry Goldwater, one of my favorites. And I guess Senator Goldwater confirmed to Clark McClellan that Goldwater's request to visit a certain storage area at Wright-Patterson was denied.
Yeah, the Blue Room. And not only that, the man that he asked, the higher military man that he asked, said, don't ever ask me that again. Don't ever put me in the position where I have to talk about this again. This is probably the most classified secret, higher, you know, they were told it was higher than the atom bomb in classification. So, yeah, there are people that have been interested. I mean, I think John Kennedy was definitely interested. Nixon, there's a story that it was good. It's supposed to be in Clark's book about Nixon letting Jackie Gleason in on the secret and Jackie Gleason wanting to see the alien bodies. Well, I'm sure that we have a few alien bodies and not just the Roswell ones.
Yeah, very interesting points. Now, you know, Paula, you had mentioned Captain Robert Salas and Malmstrom. In the connection, in connecting the dots, you include an interview with Guy Andronic and his report of apparent ET monitoring of the French nuclear tests as the French developed their own strategic defense program, or the Force de Frappe. Guy Andronic's information had a particular focus on the events surrounding the French nuclear testing in French Polynesia. Now, I see a connection here with Captain Robert Salas' reports on the Malmstrom incident. Do you, or am I just not making a good correlation?
No. You know something? That's what makes... You know, as I'm studying this, and I know this is real, and I'm a journalist, and I talk to people in the military, like Guy Andronic, who came to my apartment in Rome and told me he had followed three UFOs that flew over the base in the atoll of Fangatofa when he was they were doing the testing for the, I think it was hydrogen bomb. They did so many, I think the hundreds of tests. He said he followed them, and he said the instruments in the plane failed and they nearly crashed, but then they came back. I said, Guy, what do you think they were doing? You know, why were they there? And he goes, they were telling us that they're watching us, that we are killing all the fish, the coral, and part of the earth by trying to do these tests, you know, the tests. Guy was also part of a group of French military men who suffered, you know, with children that were born deformed, with leukemia and so forth, because they were not in bunkers when they were doing these testing in Polynesia. So Guy was pretty upset. And he's telling me that UFOs are flying over saying, stop playing around with nuclear. And the same story with Robert Salas. He was underground. He was in charge of pressing the button. And these 10 missiles were deactivated by a ball of light that was hovering over the base. It was an orange ball of light, scared the living daylights out of all the MPs that were on top of the facility. They wanted to come underground right away because they were shocked. And it was the same as the Rendlesham Forest, the Woodbridge Rendlesham Forest case that had this part of the base that had nuclear capabilities, nuclear facilities on it. And they had seen the UFO in the UK at the Woodbridge Rendlesham Forest part with a light that shone down on the nuclear, part of facilities. So you've got missiles shut down, you have flyovers in Fangatofa, and you have in the UK interest in the nuclear facilities. I think the message is very clear that we have to watch what we're doing with these dangerous toys.
Very strong points there. And, you know, before I mention your great work with Richard Hoagland, I wanted to note in the room, that's his nickname here, just in the room, but David is just beginning now to note more notes on that Romanian, and I'll just send it to you by email and have Dee do so as well. It was from United Press International, Bucharest. Romanian Defense Ministry confirmed that a fighter plane was struck by four unidentified flying objects and released a video of the incident. The ministry said the MiG-21 Lancer fighter plane was struck by the objects during an October 31, 2007. Czech flight was able to land safely. I think I'm garbling that somewhat, but I'll send off those interviews and all of those details, rather, and also have Dee email you as well. Sounds very interesting. Also, too, we're getting some more information in the room, Paula. They, too, consider your comments about Larry Warren to be very on point. Of course, Peter Robbins and Larry Warren, both composing that excellent work left at Eastgate on the Rendlesham Forest Bedwaters incident. That was just such a pivotal one. Now, you know, on Richard Hoagland, I love your work on Richard Hoagland in Connecting the Dots. It indicates Mr. Hoagland's breadth, brilliance, and timeliness of work. Also, Hoagland and team's findings on the importance of Cydonia to a possible connection with Earth civilization, also the connection with Egypt. We've got several ICAR people who often stress that. And this Cydonia connection seems to be discussed ever more widely on the Internet, also including the works of a former assistant of Mr. Hoagland, David Flynn, whose works on Cydonia and Jerusalem now are so much discussed as well. Comments on Richard Hoagland, I really love that material.
Well, you know, J.J. Hertak, one of the great researchers in the field, asked me who I thought the best researcher of all the people I had ever met and interviewed were. There are two, I think. of the best. And they're the two of the most controversial. And they're the two of my colleagues that criticize the most. And this hurts me so much because, you know, personalities are personalities. But these guys are incredible. And they are Stephen Greer, who puts his money where his mouth is and did produce all those people, you know, at the Disclosure Project.
Yes. Oh, wait one second. Joe, I think it's a tandem radio show. It's off now. Thanks. Go right ahead, Paula.
Stephen Greer, because he has done so much. I mean, I was with Stephen Greer in Italy when he was photographing the military. They were coming in and out of the hotel where we were, and he was doing it for the Disclosure Project, and Richard Hoagland. And the reason I know this is because I spent time with him. Every summer I usually spend 2 or 3 days at Richard and Robin's house. He is amazing. He actually gets up at noon, goes to bed at 7 in the morning, and spends the whole time looking at frames of Mars, knows Mars and the moon backwards and forwards. That's all he does. He is an expert at putting together, at connecting dots about what he's seeing on the Mars slides, on the Mars, the downloads that he's getting. And he gets downloads from the satellite, from the various NASA websites. And the thing is that Richard has been able to put together a scenario, which I think is viable, is probably true, that somewhere in our history, we were on Mars, and we had a civilization on Mars. And from Mars, whether you want to call it Cydonia, all the symbolism, all the sacred geometry, some of those people came to Egypt from Mars. Not that we're going there to discover a civilization. He believes, like Ray Bradbury believes, the writer, that when we go to discover the civilization on Mars, we're going to discover us, that we were there eons and eons ago. And that what the ultimate task of NASA is, and his new book, Dark Mission, is amazing, is to go back and get our technology that we left there. And I really think that it's fascinating, but he has spent a lot of time doing this. But the thing I like about Richard is that, and I talk to him a lot, he's very cultured. He knows English literature. He knows his metaphors. He reads extensively. When I've been over his house, you probably read this in my book, he throws books at me. I've read all my major books at his house. He's got a library that's incredible. So he not only puts it together from a scientific point of view, but from a cultural and a philosophical point of view. And his big hero, as you know, is Arthur C. Clarke, 2001 Space Odyssey, which I think is a magnificent masterpiece of the creation of human beings and creation of the world.
Very interesting information there. You know, recall from your interview with Richard Hoagland, and I thought this was very interesting, his importance, his including sacred geometry and geodesy in his work, Mapping Cydonia. Of course, that followed by David Flynn and his works, and it's very, very intriguing. Also from Dr. Stephen Greer, I recall your emphasis on Dr. Greer's stressing the importance of gathering evidence in a multidisciplinary context. That's really a strong point.
Well,
it's great that you noted that.
Well, you know, can I just add another thing about Stephen?
Certainly.
Maybe don't know that Stephen is very spiritual. His new book, I think it's Forbidden Truth. I forgot the title of it, but Forbidden Knowledge, something like that. And that book talks about his life story. And he was a teacher of transcendental meditation, and he had contact at a very early age. His protocols for CSETI, which I think are the best, which means a direct contact with ETs, but in a, you know, non-threatening way, going into the mountains, meditating, asking that it be benevolent, that if, you know, it's been so successful because it's a spiritual kind of contact, which I don't think is going to ever, you know, invite malevolent or what do you call it, evil people or whatever. I think it's going to invite those people with whose synchronistic lines, whose spiritual, phases are like yours. I don't think you're going to go there and get the worst of the worst if you're have a good intention of just communicating. And Stephen has been very, very successful, but his life story in his latest book tells about how spiritual he really is. He went to Jerusalem. That's where he met his wife. He did a very spiritual journey before he did any of this, before he decided to go, you know, black and white and try to get the military people aboard. He actually has quite a background and comes from it from a spiritual point of view, and he's such a strong character that people don't know that. They don't know his background. They don't know that he taught for many, many years transcendental meditation and spends a lot of time in contemplation. His gathering in Crestone, Colorado, is where I did the interview, and I'll tell you, those people spent hours getting ready for any kind of contact just by doing a lot of, you know, meditation and discussing and dialoguing and so forth. So I think, you know, looking at his protocols, and I look at them in my exopolitics book, I haven't seen anything that successful as far as communicating with ETs that I can think of.
Now, those are very intriguing comments there. You know, Paula, show will conclude at 5 to 8, your time. I'd love to reference two topics here, Clifford Stone and remote viewing. First of all, Paula, I remember from reading your interview with Clifford Stone that he emphasized that the experiences of individuals, contactees or experiencers, are sometimes so powerful that they have to be discussed among experiencers just to keep a strong focus on life and to prevent a negative impact on the individuals experiencing some of these events. Could you give some more details on Clifford Stone, whom I find very credible and just a very intriguing individual?
Well, you know, Clifford, as a young boy, he didn't understand what was happening because he had imaginary playmates. You know, a lot of these contactees, mm-hmm. Michael Wolff had imaginary. Anybody that has imaginary playmates usually has some kind of contact that, as a child, I think you think is normal. And then you realize later on that not everybody has them. And he says, you know, that it was very hard for him to tell his parents. It was very hard for him to integrate what he was, you know, experiencing, because everybody, you know, they don't think you're normal when you have these kinds of experiences. But somebody, and this is very interesting, somebody noticed that he was a contactee, and this is where you get the government involvement. And somebody, you know, came to him when he tried to buy a UFO book. When he was, you know, in his teens, it was a military man who thus became his mentor and invited him to be part of a special unit, a nuclear biological unit in the Army. And basically, Clifford thought he was going to clean up nuclear biological waste. He thought that's what he was supposed to do, and it was plane crashes. And this is part of the Disclosure Project testimony. I mean, people want to read the Stephen Greer's Disclosure Project because he was there in Washington. He said that the first time that he went to clean up something he didn't understand was 1969 in Indiantown Gap, Pennsylvania, where he saw a craft with, he said, what, you know, were alien bodies that were dead, one of them hanging out of the craft, and he freaked out so much that he basically, he asked for an officer. He said, can I get an officer down here? And the officer said, no, son, you go ahead and tell us what you see. But the reason why the officer said, you go ahead and tell us what you see, what he was really saying was, you go ahead and communicate with the being if there's anybody alive there, because you have ESP. You have this ability to do that. And Clifford, and he'll be speaking at the Bay Area. I just talked to Clifford Stone today. He'll be at the Bay Area conferences. He said it's the first time he's spoken in public in 15 years outside of Roswell. He talked about, you know, his shock the first time he had to do this. He said, but later on, and he talks in the Disclosure Project testimony, he actually let two beings go that were alive.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
He said he let them go. He said, And the reason his commanding officer said they were the enemy, and Stone said, no, they were terrified, and I thought you said they were our guests. So I think there's the big misunderstanding. Are those beings our guests, or are they the enemy? That's the big question.
Yes, indeed. And, you know, just to remind the audience, this Bay Area, this Bay UFO Expo this weekend, the 27th and 28th at Santa Clara, California, is not to be missed, including the presentations by Paula Harris, Yvonne Smith,
David
Stone.
Icke will be there.
Yes.
David Icke and people that are interested in what he has to say.
Absolutely. And, you know, I noticed, too, we had also interviewed David Icke in your Connecting the Dots, and his emphasis on the importance of appreciation of consciousness. A very interesting interview. It gave a different focus on David Icke.
Yeah, I'll talk about him. I think, by the way, the book that I think people should read, I think it's called Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge, and that's Stephen Greer's book. It's the brand new one. It's the one that talks about his life story when he was a child. A Hidden Truth, Forbidden Knowledge. So if you've got a library and you want to study this stuff, that's the book to add to it. Okay, David Icke, when I met him in Italy and I made a special effort to see him in Italy, I asked him not to get into the, you know, his typical reptilian, you know, situation. You know, I said, look, first of all, why are you doing this? You know, why are you going around lecturing? I mean, what happened in your life that made you such a great lecturer? He's a very charismatic person. I think he's an intelligent person. He was a broadcaster for the BBC. And he said, well, I went to Peru, he said, and had a spiritual experience, he said, on one of the mountains in Peru, one of the mounds of, you know, one of the burial grounds. And he said, from that, I came back and he said that I stepped out of the box. Well, you know, this is what we're talking about in the New World View or whatever, stepping out of the box. We all live in a box. So if you step out of the box, he said he saw things in a different way. He saw the manipulation of the planet. But he said, and I really believe that he's telling the truth, he said, the good news is that humanity has evolved halfway. The bad news is nobody's coming to save us. So that's in my book, because for some reason, whenever you have a situation, and this also includes the, you know, the groups of evangelical people that think that ETs are bad or good or whatever, they are not here to save us. They are not the gurus of the world. They are a big question mark of population out there in the cosmos, of which the agenda, we have no idea what it is, who want to contact humans for God knows whatever reason, and they are not here to save anybody. Even Star Trek says that it's against the directive to interfere with a culture, especially a less evolved culture, and do anything. So, you know, that interview was great because he kept it on a positive note, and he said that through our evolution, I mean, I think he probably mentioned the New Age movement and so forth, we were able to come halfway where we can maybe meet these people from the stars. And the thing that he did say, and he will talk about this in his conspiracy theories, is 9/11, though, made us go right back to the fear-based philosophy we have on this planet, and that being controlled with fear is the greatest thing that controls humanity, means that we won't do any growing spiritually, because through fear there is no spiritual growth. And so he talks about that in the interview I did in my book.
Very intriguing comments. You know, when you mention fear, I keep thinking of that phrase of Frank Herbert, fear is the mind killer. I love that Dune series there. Now, a couple of added points here. Paula, I remembered at break you were referencing your disappointment with some of the statements made by Seth Shostak and also Professor Clancy.
Goodness. Oh, goodness.
Yes, and actually, David Andrew here is mentioning in text, he's wondering what your stance is on Shostak's position that aliens have not come to Earth.
Oh, Lord. No, you know, that's insane. I met Frank Drake in San Marino, and I've met Seth also, and they have to justify their positions, but, I mean, how are you? What are you telling me that you only think aliens are going to answer you on the radio? Like, so you think that we're going to prove that there is alien life by sending out radio signals, which are so, you know, if you're having radio signals, and Edgar Mitchell is sending thought waves from the moon in 95% accurate and using just his brain, you know, using that kind of communication. And Edgar Mitchell, you know, invented afterwards noetic sciences after he came back and saw the power of thought, thought, prayer, meditation. You can add it all together. What are we doing with radio telescopes? And millions and billions of dollars in radio telescopes? Okay, so radio telescopes are one thing, but then when you see the alien in your living room, or when you have the shutdown of missiles, or when you have, you know, the Romanian group there, the Romanian plane with the four UFOs, what do you think is inside? Did they wait for a radio signal to appear? You know, and by the way, when we say they, there are so many different types of aliens. Maybe one group will answer with the radio signal. And I will remind people that Arecibo reply, the crop circle, was an answer to a radio signal, the Arecibo radio signal we sent out. And their answer is, and that was not a fake crop circle, has a little being with a big head plus a silicone basis life, not a carbon basis life. They basically told us where they were and what their basis of life was, that somebody isn't listening and somebody isn't studying, and somebody isn't connecting the dots.
Great summation there, Paula. And, you know, I remember your saying on Coast, or mentioning the importance on Coast of that May interview with Jose Gabriel Funes, the Vatican director in the Osservatore Romano. Any words, again, on the great importance of that particular article?
Yeah, I don't know what the Vatican is doing. I don't know. Why would they bother? I can see they could say, well, you know, it's not against your religion to believe in ETs. I mean, that's normal. You can say that. But why add he's my brother and sister? Or he could be my brother and sister. He's not referring to the grades, obviously. To be a brother and sister. And then they add dogma or doctrine there. Doctrine and dogma, it means that you add something that everybody needs to believe in. And they added that Jesus Christ didn't have to die for them because humans are the only ones born with original sin, that people off-world or off-world planets aren't born with original sin. Well, what does that mean? Are we starting a new doctrine? Are we starting to have a part B of religion so that we're getting ready for the contact? I just don't understand why he couldn't just leave it at, you know, we believe that there could be ET life. I mean, even SETI says that. We believe there's probably people out there. They don't realize they're already here. But, you know, the Vatican for me was jostling into position for some future event, which don't ask me what it is, which will happen in the next 10 years. And I really would go on record saying that in the next 10 years, we will have a few answers.
That was going to be a momentous of development. Very intriguing comments there. Now, you know, Paula, we've got about 3 minutes left, and I was just wondering if you could briefly reference your interview series on the remote viewers. You have Ingo Swann viewing non-human intelligences from both sides of the moon, Paul Smith, discussion of remote viewing capabilities, Courtney Brown mentioning scientific fail-safes, physicist Russell Targ founding Expert in the Field, knowing the quantum connection link to consciousness. Gee, comments on remote viewing. I love that series of interviews in Connecting the Dots on that subject.
Well, you know, I talked to all those people. I mean, it isn't like I read a book and I learned about them through the book. I talked to Ingo Swann, and I said to him, you know, did you really see non-human intelligence on the dark side of the moon? And he said, yeah, I also saw it on the light side. Well, he said on the light side. I said, you mean, you know, like the part we can see, there's like non-human intelligence walking around? And he said, yes. Now, he also, in his book, Penetration, and I really recommend this book for people that want to start having a library, talks about seeing a woman in California in a supermarket that he knew was an alien woman that was not a human. He said he knew she wasn't. He saw two CIA agents who came up to him and said, don't go near her because we're keeping her under guard. And I thought, oh, Lord. You know, Ingo Swann is a great remote viewer. He trained remote viewers. Paul Smith has an incredible, you know, he's the president of the International Remote Viewing Society, and he gave me an incredible interview on how the general public can be trained, because he was trained as a military remote viewer, but because he had a propensity towards art, a sensitivity, artists have a sensitivity and intuition, they make great remote viewers, and of course, Courtney Brown is amazing. I met him this summer here in Boulder for the first time, but I did a telephone interview with him, and his Farsight Institute does double-blind studies, which means just with coordinates of things that will happen in the future. So the Farsight Institute, if you want to look at what that work they've done, and people online can go ahead and be part of that.
Wonderful. Now, Paula, we have about a minute left here. I want to thank you for an extremely informative and dynamic interview. Your site being, again, www.paulaharris.com. Also, wonderful courses being given at Exopolitics Institute. Their semester began today. Paula, final words for us this evening.
Well, you have to look at what the events are on the planets, their sightings. If you look at my website, you'll see that there are sightings around that super collider that went off in Bern, Switzerland. You'll see on my website that they had sightings in England all of a sudden that were attached to that day. And you need to attach them to major events on the planet. Someone is interested in us.
Very powerful points, very intriguing and informative interview. Thank you, Paula. And to our audience, thanks so much for joining this evening, joining our discussion. Good night and good week, everyone.